But in another minute, they were in the sitting room of the house, a small high chamber with a stone floor, full of moving shadows cast by a wood fire that flickered on a great hearth. Something of the character of an oratory was imparted to it by a tall crucifix, which reached almost to the ceiling on one side. The figure was painted of the natural colors, the cross was black. Under this stood a chest of some age and solidity, and when a lamp had been brought and chairs set, the sacristan went to this chest and produced therefrom, with growing excitement and nervousness, as Denniston thought, a large book wrapped in a white cloth, on which cloth a cross was rudely embroidered in red thread. Even before the wrapping had been removed, Denniston began to be interested by the size and shape of the volume. "Too large for a missal," he thought, "and not the shape of an antiphoner. Perhaps it may be something good after all." The next moment the book was open, and Denniston felt that he had at last lit upon something better than good. Before him lay a large folio, bound, perhaps, late in the 17th century, with the arms of Canon Albrecht de Molian stamped in gold on the sides. There may have been 150 leaves of paper in the book, and on almost every one of them was fastened a leaf from an illuminated manuscript. Such a collection Denniston had hardly dreamed of in his wildest moments. Here were 10 leaves from a copy of Genesis, illustrated with pictures which could not be later than 700 A.D. Further on was a complete set of pictures from a psalter of English execution of the very finest kind that the 13th century could produce. And perhaps best of all, there were 20 leaves of uncial writing in Latin, which, as a few words seen here and there told him at once, must belong to some very early unknown patristic treatise. Could it possibly be a fragment of the copy of Papias on the words of our Lord, which was known to have existed as late as the 12th century at Nîmes? In any case, his mind was made up. The book must return to Cambridge with him, even if he had to draw the whole of his balance from the bank and stay at St. Bertrand till the money came. He glanced up at the sacristan to see if his face yielded any hint that the book was for sale. The sacristan was pale, and his lips were working.
"If Monsieur will turn on to the end," he said.
So Monsieur turned on, meeting new treasures at every rise of a leaf. And at the end of the book he came upon 2 sheets of paper, of much more recent date than anything he had yet seen, which puzzled him considerably. They must be contemporary, he decided, with the unprincipled Canon Albrecht, who had doubtless plundered the chapter library of St. Bertrand to form this priceless scrapbook. On the first of the paper sheets was a plan, carefully drawn and instantly recognizable by a person who knew the ground, of the south aisle and cloisters of St. Bertrand's. There were curious signs looking like planetary symbols, and a few Hebrew words in the corners, and in the northwest angle of the cloister was a cross drawn in gold paint. Below the plan were some lines of writing in Latin, which are translated thus: "Answers of the 12th of December, 1694. It was asked, 'Shall I find it?' Answer, 'Thou shalt.' 'Shall I become rich?' 'Thou wilt.' 'Shall I live an object of envy?' 'Thou wilt.' 'Shall I die in my bed?' 'Thou wilt.'" A good specimen of the treasure hunter's record. Quite reminds one of Mr. Minor Canon Quatermain's in Old St. Paul's, was Denniston's comment, and he turned the leaf. What he saw then impressed him, as he has often told me, more than he could have conceived any drawing or picture capable of impressing him. And though the drawing he saw is no longer in existence, there's a photograph of it, which I possess, which fully bears out that statement. The picture in question was a sepia drawing at the end of the 17th century, representing, one might say at first sight, a biblical scene. For the architecture, the picture represented an interior, and the figures had that semi-classical flavor about them which the artists of 200 years ago thought appropriate to illustrations of the Bible. On the right was a king on his throne, the throne elevated on 12 steps, a canopy overhead, soldiers on either side, evidently King Solomon. He was bending forward with outstretched scepter in attitude of command. His face expressed horror and disgust, yet there was in it also the mark of imperious command and confident power. The left half of the picture was the strangest, however, the interest plainly centered there. On the pavement before the throne were grouped four soldiers, surrounding a crouching figure which must be described in a moment. A fifth soldier lay dead on the pavement, his neck distorted and his eyeballs starting from his head. The four surrounding guards were looking at the king. In their faces, the sentiment of horror was intensified. They seemed, in fact, only restrained from flight by their implicit trust in their master. All this terror was plainly excited by the being that crouched in their midst. I entirely despair of conveying by any words the impression which this figure makes upon anyone who looks at it. I recollect once showing the photograph of the drawing to a lecturer on morphology, a person of, I was going to say, abnormally sane and unimaginative habits of mind. He absolutely refused to be alone for the rest of that evening, and he told me afterwards that for many nights he had not dared to put out his light before going to sleep. However, the main traits of the figure I can at least indicate. At first you saw only a mass of coarse, matted black hair. Presently it was seen that this covered a body of fearful thinness, almost a skeleton, but with the muscles standing out like wires. The hands were of a dusky pallor, covered like the body with long, coarse hairs and hideously taloned. The eyes, touched in with a burning yellow, had intensely black pupils, and were fixed upon the throned king with a look of beast-like hate. Imagine one of the awful bird-catching spiders of South America translated into human form, and endowed with intelligence just less than human. You have some faint conception of the terror inspired by the appalling effigy. One remark is universally made by those who have seen the picture. It was drawn from the life. As soon as the first shock of his irresistible fright had subsided, Dennison stole a look at his host. The sacristan's hands were pressed upon his eyes. The daughter, looking up at the cross on the wall, was telling her beads feverishly. At last, the question was asked, "Is this book for sale?" There was the same hesitation, the same plunge of determination that he had noticed before, and then came the welcome answer, "If Monsieur pleases." "How much do you ask for it?"
"I will take 250 francs."
This was confounding. Even a collector's conscience is sometimes stirred, and Denniston's conscience was tenderer than a collector's.
"My good man," he said again and again, "your book is worth far more than 250 francs, I assure you, far more."
But the answer did not vary.
"I will take 250 francs, not more."
There was really no possibility of refusing such a chance. The money was paid, the receipt signed, a glass of wine drunk over the transaction, and then the sacristan seemed to become a new man. He stood upright. He ceased to throw those suspicious glances behind him. He actually laughed, or tried to laugh. Denniston rose to go.
"I shall have the honour of accompanying Monsieur to his hotel," said the sacristan.
"Oh, no, thanks. It isn't 100 yards. I know the way perfectly, and there's a moon." The offer was pressed 3 or 4 times, and refused as often.
"Then Monsieur would summon me if he finds occasion. He will keep the middle of the road. The sides are so rough."
"Certainly, certainly," said Denniston, who was impatient to examine his prize by himself, and he stepped out into the passage with his book under his arm. Here he was met by the daughter. She, it appeared, was anxious to do a little business on her own account, perhaps like Gehazi, to take somewhat from the foreigner whom her father had spared.
A silver crucifix and a chain for the neck. Monsieur would perhaps be good enough to accept it?
Well, really, Denniston hadn't much use for these things. And what did Mademoiselle want for it?
Nothing, nothing in the world. Monsieur's more than welcome to it.
The tone in which this and much more was said was unmistakably genuine, so that Denniston was reduced to profuse thanks and submitted to have the chain put round his neck. It really seemed as if he had rendered the father and daughter some service, which they hardly knew how to repay. As he set off with his book, they stood at the door looking after him, and they were still looking when he waved them a last good night from the steps of the Chapeau Rouge.